My name's Larry Johnson, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's truly because of God's grace and the help of people just like yourselves, and certainly the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, it has not been necessary for me to take a drink of an alcoholic nature since the 18th of September, 1972, and for that I'm very thankful. Well, I didn't really think anybody would be impressed by that. I am, or I wouldn't have brought it up. I'm reminded of a story, and I'm not much of a storyteller, except my own. I love drunkalogs, and I like mine. I could listen to my drunkalog a long time, you know, and I do, going up and down the road, and especially if I'm scheduled to talk at a meeting somewhere. I don't know which talk I've made that was the one that you really should have heard, but the one you're going to hear is the one that we're going to do this morning. There was a family that had a little boy born into this family, and for 6 years he never said a word, never talked. And one morning at breakfast, as they were, Dad was getting ready to go to work, and Mom was kind of getting the day started, and the little fellow was sitting at the kitchen table, and he looked at his mother, and he said, "This oatmeal is lumpy." And they just thought, gee whiz, he spoke. And they sat down, and they loved him, and they said, "God, we're so glad that you can talk, and it was 6 years, and you haven't said a word, and it's a miracle." He said, "No, up to now, everything's been okay." And up to now, everything's been okay. And it's still okay. I am honored to be here. It's always a privilege for me to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would like to thank Ken for the phone call. I want to thank Mike for the referral. It's nice to know you got people out there that would actually recommend you to someone. And I'm going to think about the introduction, and I may thank him later. Mike came down yesterday afternoon and made my bed for me. It's the first time I've ever had a man make my bed. And I appreciate it. And he did a good job. Said that when he was drinking, he worked in motels and stuff. When I was drinking, I lived in motels and stuff. I didn't ever work hardly anywhere. I want to thank Gloria last night for her talk, and Ellen for a fine Al-Anon talk this morning. There's a lot of powerful stuff came out of that talk. And I'm one of those members of Alcoholics Anonymous that I love Al-Anon. I'm not a member of Al-Anon. I don't have any reason to be. I love a lot of alcoholics, but I have a program, and it looks just like theirs. And I'm not going to get on any soapboxes or anything today, although I'm very capable of doing that. And I'm going to do what I was taught to do here in just a minute, but there's just no reason for me to leave Alcoholics Anonymous to find a way to live. And I've never had to leave AA to find another way to live sober, and I'll be eternally grateful for that. And Ellen mentioned the 12 and 12 frequently, and the only, I don't have a lot of that particular piece of material memorized, but I do remember the description of Alcoholics Anonymous, our recovery program, as well as I've ever heard it described, is in the foreword to that book. And where it says that AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, which if practiced as a way of life can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. That's powerful stuff. And I'll share with you my story, and it's important that that we share our story, because then that it gives hope to the newcomer and really expresses the power that lies in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It could take a guy like me and turn a guy like me into a useful, productive human being, which I was not before I came to you. My tale of woe is not really spectacular. I grew up in a little cotton mill village in North Carolina. Not much goes on in cotton mill villages in North Carolina. People get up and go to work and pay their bills, and the kids grow up and go to school, and we just did what people do in little cotton mill villages in North Carolina. And except our house was a little different. We had excitement down at our house. My dad was a pretty good drinker. Now, Dad may have been an alcoholic. It's possible that he may have been. But on the weekends, drinking was not unusual at our house on the weekends. My dad had a lot of brothers and sisters, and they all liked to drink. And they'd all come to our house on Sunday, and my mother was the best cook in the whole family, and they would come, and Mom fix a big Sunday dinner, and we would all eat dinner, and then they would commence to drinking that white liquor. We call it white liquor down where I live. Some people call it moonshine, and it's been, you know, it has a lot of different names. But they get to drinking and cussing and fighting and just kind of putting on a show. Nobody on our street had a television that didn't need one. They just sat out on the porch and watched what was going on at our house. And so I knew about drinking and what drinking could do, and I knew that I'd never drink. I knew that I would never drink. And I never wanted to be like my father, and because of the way he drank. And then when he stopped drinking, then I would like to have been like he was. And I knew I'd never drink like he did, and I never did. I don't know that my dad ever walked the streets. I know that he never walked the streets of Dallas, Texas while he was drinking. But I took my first drink when I was 15. And that was, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1972, that was about the average age. And now today, I hear people talking about starting out when they were 8, 9 years old. I feel a little wimpy. You know, I ain't kind of a wimp. I waited so long to get started, you know. But it was when I got started, and a bunch of guys on the way to a high school football game pulled into a drive-in restaurant on a Friday night, and there were 6 of us in the car. It was an old Ford convertible. And they all ordered a beer, and they turned to me in the back seat and said, "Larry, what would you like?" And I said, "I'd like to have one of those too." And they handed me a big, tall can of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. And that was the most god-awful tasting stuff. I never had another Pabst after that. That was some nasty tasting stuff. But as I drank it down, and it changed me. It changed the way I looked at things. It changed the way I was. I was no longer that little 5 foot, 935-pound ninth grader or 10th grader or what, I guess a ninth grader. And I just, we were going to the football game, and I thought that I had really made a mistake. I should have went out for quarterback. And I was scared of my own shadow, and I was scared to death of girls. And I did, and we got to the football game, and there was a girl in that I grew up across the street from, and I really wanted to talk to Sarah, but I just never, I'd get up right next to her and I'd just start babbling, you know, and it's fine. But this night, boy, I looked up in the bleachers and I saw her sitting up there, and I climbed them bleachers and I went up and sat down next to her and started talking to her, and she looked at me and she said, "Larry Johnson, have you been drinking?" And I said, "Well, I had a beer." And next thing she said, "I'm going to tell your daddy." And I got in trouble the first time I ever drank. And it never got any better, it just got worse. I know that I was a social drinker for 15 or 20 minutes. It didn't exceed that. And the reason I can say that is that night we only drank one beer because they wouldn't go back and get another one. That's probably the only guy in the car that wanted to do that. I'm the only one of those fellows that was in that car that night that ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and chances are I'm the only one that had a need to ever come to AA. And I drank. I got back up there, obviously, as soon as I could, and And I drank as much as there was for as long as it lasted for the next 5 years. In 1959, a buddy and I ran head on to a semi on a rainy 4th of July night. And everybody gets real quiet when I tell that. It's not really that dramatic. We're riding down Highway 74, which is a connector to the mountains to the coast of North Carolina, and we've been drinking all day. And old Earl looked at me and he said, "How about a cup of coffee?" And I said, "Sure. Why not?" And he said, "How about Johnny's?" And I said, "Johnny's would be good. Johnny's a little truck stop there on the side of the highway." And I didn't know we were already there. And he made a left-hand turn into a wet gravel parking lot and hit the brakes on that old car, and we slid head-on to a semi that was parked at the fuel tanks. Now, it took some growth on my part to straighten that story out. Because I used to love to tell it and just said it, and just to tell you that I had had this encounter with a semi, and everybody kind of goes, "Ooh, man, that's a miracle stinging." But that's the way it was. The impact was hard enough to throw me into the windshield, put a goose egg on my head. I ended up in the hospital later that night. The doctor gave me three little yellow-looking things, and he said, take one of these. It'll help you sleep. And I went home, took all three of them, and slept until about 4 o'clock that afternoon. And I woke up that next afternoon, and I was laying back on my bed. I was out of the Army, and I was living with my mother and father. Dad wasn't drinking anymore. And I lay there, and it's probably the first inventory I ever took. And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know anything about being an alcoholic. None of that stuff really interested me. But I lay back there, and I think, you know, if old Norm used to talk about seconds and inches, and that's really kind of the way it is out there, and had the timing been a little different, you know, we could have really got done in on this deal. And I got to think about all the trouble I had been in up to that point in my life. I didn't get in trouble every time I drank, but you can be assured that every time I got in trouble during that period of my life, I had been drinking. And the most intelligent thought that I had ever had up to that point probably came next. And the thought was, you need to stop drinking. You know, if you stop drinking, a lot of these problems would go away. That's what everybody had been telling me. You know, if you just didn't drink. So I decided I wouldn't drink anymore. Just made the decision. I'm 20 years old. And it was kind of a scary thought that I'm never going to drink again. And I had learned to really depend on that to get me through life. You know, days and nights and everything that I'd ever done had been centered around drinking. And I went in and I thought, well, I don't know if I can do this. And I said, well, I talked to my dad and my mom and go into their room. And I told them about my decision. It was kind of like AA. They hugged me and wished me well. They didn't give me a chip or anything, but they... And I asked my dad, I said, "Dad, how did you do this?" Because I knew Dad was bad to drink. And I said, "What I do?" And it's kind of like a sponsor. He said, "You do what I do." And what he was doing, he was going to church. So the next night, I find myself in church with my mom and my dad. And then when the meeting's over, I find myself down in the front, and everybody's wishing me well on my new life. So I spent the next 3 years not drinking. Ellen only had to endure 11 months of that. I spent the next 3 years not drinking but wanting to drink. And a lot of things happened during that next 3 years. I met a girl. I got reacquainted with a girl that I'd grown up next door to. And I was playing baseball, and a buddy and I were coming home from a ball game one afternoon, and I look across. I live, I just have to kind of describe this little village I grew up in. We had a company store. And the company store was the store, and all the people that worked in the mill had an account at this company store. And we lived two houses behind the company store, and down a hill, but there was a big parking lot at the company store. We were walking across this parking area, and I look across the street, and I see this girl, in this porch swing. Now this stuff sounds really corny. This really happened. I mean, you know, y'all remember this? There's a country and western song out a few years ago, "Just a Swingin'." Well, she's on this porch swing, just a swingin', and I looked across and I asked my buddy, I said, "Who is that?" And he said, "That's Betty Lou." And I said, "That's Betty Lou?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "God, the last time I saw Betty Lou, she was, you know, a little bitty." And he said, "That's Betty Lou." And Betty Lou had on a pair of hot pink short shorts. And I went home and I got on the phone and I called Betty Lou. And I invited myself to come by and see her later that evening. I just told her I'd be by to see her later. And she didn't say it was okay or not okay, but I remember walking up the hill, and she was it was after supper, and it was dark, was kind of settling, and she was back out on that porch swing and still had on them shorts. And I made the block a couple of times, kind of like a guy coming to AA, you know, you just kind of circle the block a few times before you come in. And finally I got enough courage to walk up on that porch. I ended up in that swing that night. And Betty Lou and I were married in April of the next year. And I always believed, I didn't look real close, but I've always believed that the marriage certificate was signed by the Secretary of War. And it just started almost instantly, the fight was on. And we did that for 5.5 years. And we didn't fight all the time. She had 3 pregnancies. During that time, so we did make up some, and we lost our first child at childbirth, but we ended up with 2 beautiful children in this marriage, and it was just one of those deals that wasn't meant to be. And I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned most everything, if not everything I know that's worth knowing, I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous or since coming to AA. And that's not to belittle my upbringing or any of the limited education that I have. But I've learned this. If you're married wrong, you're married wrong. And there just ain't much you can do about it. And we worked and we fixed and we wrenched and we did everything we could on that marriage, and it just was not to be. And I went through some dry periods. I was sober when she and I got married. One of the first questions that Betty asked me was, "Do you drink?" And I'd learned the answer to that question long before I ever met her. The answer to that question is no. You know, "Have you been drinking?" No. And I'd give that question as I was falling over. The police officer says, "Have you been drinking?" No, sir. Then you get into the conversation. I got stopped by the police yesterday, by the way, on the way to this deal. You know, I really feel for Bob and for Mickey and all these flight connections that they had encountered and all the delays and everything. I feel fortunate coming to this deal. I just got in my car and drove up here. It took 5.5 hours, but that's okay. But coming through this little town of Hulbert, listening to an AA talk on the radio, on my tape player, and I wasn't paying any attention. They're having a parade. I was kind of watching all the kids getting ready for a homecoming parade up there. And then I saw the police officer. You see, if he'd have given me a ticket, I'd have called him a cop. Right? But he's a police officer. And he pulled me over, and I gave him my license, and he asked me about the speed limit, if I was aware. I said no. And he wanted to know where I was going. I said, "I'm going over to the other side of Tahlequah to an AA meeting." Believe it or not, he said, "You come all the way from Dallas to an AA meeting?" I said, "Well, it's a special meeting. It's a weekend deal, and you don't want him." I don't see him here. He sure had a lot of questions about your deal up here. You know. he gave me a warning, and he and I, that's when we really started getting along. He said, "So anyhow, that's why he's a police officer." Anyhow, Well, I shouldn't do that. I'm not with the mind that I have. I should never leave. I may never get back to where I was at. Anyhow, when she said, do you drink? I said, no. And I said, why'd you ask? She said, my father is a bad drinker, and I don't like people that drink. And I said, never have to worry about that with me. My son was almost 2 years old. One afternoon, I was working on the best job I'd ever had in my life. I had a great job. I was a young man, 23 years old or so, and just had a great job. Worked for a retail furniture company. It was a nice, clean work. I had left the cotton mill. I went to work in the cotton mill when I got out of the Army. But I'd left the cotton mill, and I was working with the nice people. And one afternoon, I made what had turned out to be a real bad error in judgment for me. I started to thinking. An alcoholic either needs to think or drink. He shouldn't do both of them. And I started to thinking about drinking. I got to thinking, God, it's been 3 years, and I got this good job, and I got everything going for me. You know, everything's going good. You know, I'm living down at the end of the street in the little white house with the shutters on the windows. I got trees in the backyard. There's a creek running through the tree. I mean, everything is good. There's nothing's wrong. So I pull over to a VFW club, and I order a couple of beers, and I drink two beers, and I started getting that feeling. You know, I felt myself getting there where we like to be, and I got a little scary, and I left because I didn't want to get in trouble. And I did a little controlled drinking that afternoon. That may be the only time I was ever able to do that. And I left, but I came back. And for the next 6 months, I drank different than I'd ever drank in my life. I tried to control it. I tried to hide it. And I was bringing the paycheck home. I don't know about anybody else, but when I started drinking, I did things different. You know, I'm bringing this paycheck home. The money's got to come from somewhere. And so I start stealing, and it was just kind of taking it. I'm going to put it back kind of deal. I was always going to put it back, and, well, I didn't get to put it back. And I lost that job. And right after Christmas of 1964, the marriage dissolved. I moved to Greensboro, North Carolina, to start a new life. And I thought, if I get up there and I get squared away and up there, I can get her, and now we have two children. My daughter Kimberly was born 34 years ago yesterday. And so now we got these two kids, and I don't like my life. I don't like where we're living, and I don't like her mom and daddy, and I just don't like anything that's going on. And what I needed more than anything else was a drink. I didn't even know it. And I had stopped again or quit again. I didn't really stop drinking until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to quit a lot, though. And I'm going to get up there, and we're going to get this new life going. And I'm interviewing for this job. And the guy asked me, do you drink? And it was at the end of the interview, I knew I had the job. You know, those of us that have gone, you know, when you sit in the interview, and you can tell, by the way, the interview's gone, whether or not you're going to get the job or not. Well, I was certain that I had the job. I had the qualifications for it. And it was in the retail furniture business, and he didn't ask me a lot of personal questions until he got to the end, and he said, Larry, do you drink? And the answer to that is no. And I said, no, I don't. He said, good. And I said, why'd you ask me that question? He said, well, the man that you're going to replace is an alcoholic, and we don't want any more of those in my company. And I said, I don't blame you. I never like to be around them. You can't depend on them. They don't show up for work. You know, they wish to go through all this. And so he hired me, and a few months later, we're closing the store one Saturday afternoon, and he called me in the office. He said, J.D. and Willie, and J.D. was drove the delivery truck, and Willie was his helper, and J.D. and Willie had gone down to the liquor store, and they're going to get a pint of vodka and have a little drink before we leave today. How about joining us for a drink? And I said, but Ed, you know that I don't drink. And he said, yeah, I know, Larry. And I said, well, I don't drink. And he said, I know, but Larry, we're just going to have a drink. And have a drink with us. Man, it was just a drink. I said, oh, okay. And so they brought the pint in, and I looked at the pint, and I set it on the desk there, and the pints, and I've got this kind of mind, and there was 16 ounces in a pint. One, two, three, four, and that's not much. It's just, he's right, it's just a drink. So we had a drink. J.D. and Willie went home, Ed went home, and I left for California. Because when I drink, I make trips. I leave town when I start drinking. I mean, I went home, started making plans to leave town. It was a rotten town to start with, you know, and so I'm on my way to college. It took a while. I mean, you can't just leave right now. You got to kind of get it together. And if you don't have a car, it's really hard to leave. And I was walking everywhere, but I had a roommate that had a 57 Cadillac. And Chuck, he was wanting to leave too, so Chuck and I packed everything that we owned into this old 57 Cadillac, left a little room in the back seat to sleep, and we had a little room left over. The neighbors had gone to the beach for the weekend, and we were missing a couple of items, so we kind of just filled in the gaps and, you know, to balance out the load, and we head for California. And man, in my life, I know my life's about to change, because I'm going to California. It's 1965. And you know, somebody in this room remember 1965. I mean, California was, it was happening out there. I mean, everything. The beatnik generation was dying off, and the hippie generation was about to was just kind of getting started. And man, I lived in that world, that fantasy world, and my whole life was one big fantasy anyhow, man, I'm going to get to California, and it's going to be great, man. I've got these two kids back here, but they're going to be okay because I'm coming back to take care of that. I'd been in jail a couple of times. We're going to talk about that. I don't really like to talk about all the times I was in jail. It's kind of depressing. I've been in enough jails to do us all. I don't really care much to talk about that. I just let you know, if you need a resume, I can give you one. And I'm thinking, I'll get out there, and I may change my name. You know, I may get me a new name. And you know, hippies had different names. You know, that was, you know, the Moondog and all those kind of names. You know. And I don't know anything about this except what I read and saw on TV. And that's kind of where I live, you know, was in that TV. And I just, you know, I just kind of become someone. And there was a guy, there's two guys on TV back in those days that had a red Corvette. You remember Route 66? Man, those guys lived an exciting life. And I'm thinking, oh, Chuck and I, we'll be like those guys. And one of the guys from the Midwest and the other one's from Hell's Kitchen. And I mean, you know, I'm from a cottonmill village in North Carolina and Chuck's from Lakeland, Florida. But, you know, it don't make any difference. You know, it's all as Clancy always says, it's all in how you perceive things to be anyhow. And we'll be like those guys. We got a green four-door 57 Cadillac with the fenders that high. I mean, it's not as sleek looking as that little red Corvette, but we'll get it done. I get on the beach out there, and I'll cut my blue jeans off and cut the sleeves out of my shirt, let my hair grow down, and grow me a beard maybe, and give me some of them open-toed shoes, and find myself. Because that's what we were doing. Everybody was looking for themselves. We went in a restaurant here a while back, my wife and I, and it was a sign up there that said, I have gone to find myself. Should I return before I get back, please have me wait. And I didn't know this, but my wife wrote that down, and on her computer at work, she made an 8x10 of it, framed it, brought it home, and handed it to me. I'll find myself. Maybe, I don't know what would have happened. We made it all the way to Fort Worth. End of the journey. Ended right there. Never went any further west. I went to Chico one time. The word Chico, Texas is, you got to know where Chico's at to even know where I'm talking. It's out on I-20 somewhere between somewhere and somewhere else out there. It all looks the same to me out there, but we never made it any further. One of the problems we had was we didn't have as much money as we thought we had. Now, we come into this high living when we hit Fort Worth. And we hold up for a couple of days at the Y downtown. And then we rent us a little duplex apartment over on South Henderson Street. And you just have to know Fort Worth to know where South Henderson is. It's not South Fort Worth. Not over there where the Leonards and all those people live. But we're holed up in this little apartment over there, and I get a job selling cars. I walked in, the guy said, "You ever sold cars before?" And I said, "No, sir." He said, "Be here in the morning, and we'll teach you how to sell cars." And they taught me how to sell cars, and I liked the car business because it was almost instant money. And I never had any instant money like that. And we got paid every Friday, and it wasn't hard to do. It never was hard for me in the beginning, but Fort Worth became a bad place to live. At Christmas Eve, 1965, I took out two cars on South Henderson and took the steps off a man's front porch. And I thought, this is not a good town. I didn't like it to start with. So what I'll do is I'll leave this rotten town. And the cop came. And he was a cop. And it was after talking to him, I decided I needed to leave Fort Worth. And I thought, I'll move to Dallas. I really like Dallas. We came through Dallas on the way to Fort Worth. Dallas looked like a pretty good place to live to me. So I moved to Dallas, and my life starts changing a little bit right here. You know, and I think about the meetings that I sat in the early days in Alcoholics Anonymous, and how until I changed, I would still be whatever you wanted me to be. And I would sit in those meetings, and I would hear people say things, and people would chuckle or nod their head. And when it come my turn, I would say what they said to get your approval. And I wanted to belong so bad. But I heard a guy say one time to me, "Nothing good ever happened to me when I was drinking." Come my turn, I said, "Nothing good ever happened to me when I was drinking." But that's not true. There's a lot of good things happened to me when I was drinking. But I had formed such a low opinion of myself that I couldn't recognize anything good coming into my life. When I met this girl in the middle of January of 1967 or 66, and I knew immediately that she was good people. And I met her family, and I knew they were good people. And they weren't the kind of people that I'd been accustomed to being around. And I didn't think I deserved to be around people like that. And we started this courtship, if you could call it that. But we'd go out on a date for a while, and then we wouldn't, then we would. In May of 1967, Sam and I were married. On the 27th of May, 1967. Her name is Anita, and I call her Sam, because she's my Sam. And the long odds on that marriage was 30 days. In this past May, we completed 31 years of marriage. And we owe that to Alcoholics Anonymous and to Al-Anon. But without the fellowship, this marriage would have never survived, not in sobriety. We've had more rocky roads in sobriety than we ever. When I was drinking, that's what I did. I just drank. And Sam she's educated, she's bright, and as I said, she's a good person. And I know that Sam is intelligent enough that had she known what she was getting into, she would not have come along for that ride. Had she been able to roll back the curtain just a little bit to see what she was about to get into. But she said, I've heard her said in giving her Al-Anon talk that she knew that I was kind of a bad case. But she knew that if we got married, I'd settle down. And I thought so too. We were married about 6 months. I had worked real hard in the car business and had been promoted into the management. And I really, my old ego had really got way out there. I mean, I had a bad ego problem when I came to Alcoholics and all of anything when I came to you all. I'd lost everything I had by the time I got to you. But I was 6 months into the marriage. I'm out all night for the first time. This is my first time to stay out all night. And I get home, it's about 8:30 on a Sunday morning. And I walk, and the paper's at the door. I pick the paper up. I walk in the house, and I look. I go to the refrigerator first and pull a beer from the icebox, and I look into the bedroom. And we had a little apartment over in East Dallas at the time. And I look in the bedroom, and Sam she's laying on the bed. The bed has not been slept in. And she's been on that bed all night, or up and down off of it all night, and probably pacing the floor all night, wondering where I was at. And I don't know, you just have to, she talks about some of the thoughts that went through her mind. But let me tell you what happened. She didn't say a word to me. She didn't speak. And I didn't speak. Because I learned, you know, the way I live my life, the first one to speak usually loses. And so I didn't say anything. I went in, I showered, I got ready for bed, put on the bed clothes, and got my paper and my beer, went around and crawled into bed on my side of the bed, spread the paper out, and got ready to do my Sunday morning deal, which was read the paper and drink a little beer. So when I got into bed, she got out of the bed. And when she got out of the bed, she walked to the nightstand on her side, and she pulled the drawer out, and from the drawer she took a 38, there was a 38 pistol in that drawer, and she took that pistol out. Now, the pistol wasn't loaded. We'd agreed we'd keep the gun in the house, we wouldn't keep it loaded. But the bullets were in the drawer, and she took two bullets out of the drawer. And I didn't know this girl could handle a gun like that. And she flipped that chamber open, and then she slipped two bullets in there, and she slapped it shut. And she pulled that hammer back, and she began to spin that wheel, and she lined the bullet up with the firing pin. And I watched her with great anticipation. And I knew now is the time that someone needs to create some kind of dialogue. Now, I wasn't going to ask her, what are you going to do with a gun? I know what people do with guns. But my question was, and what I was puzzled about, were the two bullets. And I said, why? And the way I started, I said, honey. Why did you just put two bullets in the gun? And with tears running down her face, and she said, Larry, I can't live like this. I won't live like this. I can't do this. One of these is for you, and one's for me. And I did the greatest selling job that morning I ever did in my life. And I talked that gun out of her hands. And I got rid of that gun because I knew I couldn't keep the promises I made her. Because I made her some promises I knew I couldn't keep. I mean, I'd said things to her like, you know, honey, the dealership closes at 9. I'm home at 9:15. I didn't ever tell her I was going to stop drinking. I mean, we don't get carried away with this thing, you know. But I said, I'm going to the liquor store tomorrow. I'm going to get some booze. I'm going to bring it home. I'm going to be a home drinker. I'll come home from work and we'll have a drink and, you know, our life's going to change. You just put that gun away. And we got rid of the gun. And, of course, I couldn't keep the promises. And Sam heard me tell that story a couple of years ago. And on the way home from the meeting, she said, yeah, I listened as you told that story. And she said, you know, that's pretty accurate. That's pretty much the way it went that morning. But she said, I've done a lot of thinking about that. And I said, you have? She said, yeah. And she said, Larry, I'm not real sure how to use my bullet. You need to hear that when you're about 20 years sober. Bill Wilson calls it ego deflation at depth. Well, I'll tell you, that'll take the air out of your balloon, I guarantee you. Well, obviously it never got better, it just got worse. The job changes, the moves, we moved a lot. I finally found somebody, I had to go to Al-Anon to find her, somebody had more jobs than I did in 1 year. but I did mine sober. first year I was sober, I had 11 jobs. I didn't like my job. Yeah, you know, I fit the mold of the newcomer. Newcomer don't like his job. The countless number of men that I've been able to sponsor over the years in Alcoholics Anonymous, never been one of them that liked their job. First thing, so I like my job. And I said, don't worry about it. Nobody does. And but I had 11 jobs. That concerned me. I went to my sponsor. I said, well, I want you to look at this. He said, what do you got? And I laid down 11 of those income tax forms. He said, what's the problem? I said, do you see, I've had 11 jobs this year. He said, Larry, you look at this wrong. He said, your whole perception of this thing is wrong. He said, everything that you're doing is negative. He said, look at it this way. In 1 year, you found 11 jobs. Now, that ought to tell you something. There's work out there if you're willing to do it. And don't worry about it. And so I've never worried about it, and I haven't changed jobs in 15 years now. But as I said, nothing. It never got better. It got worse, and we moved a lot, and I lost jobs, and I kept thinking about that deal over in North Carolina, and not many people knew about that. Sam knew about it, and a couple other people knew about my two kids back there, and I carry that around, and many a night I'd bury all that with a jug of whiskey, but it never went away, and. I was arrested the last time on the 29th of August of 1972 for DWI. And I remember about 3 o'clock in the morning I came to in that drunk tank, and they didn't have the programs that they have now back then. They threw everybody in a drunk tank. This thing is, I don't know how many they're supposed to be built for, but they were, we packed us in there like cattle. You know, and that's kind of the way they looked. It's just the drunks, just all the drunks in that tank over there. And I remember the first time I was ever in that drunk tank, and I knew I didn't belong there. And I stood up all night, and I looked around at all of these people. And I knew that I didn't belong there. And thank you for what you said this morning. I didn't know that I was looking at my future. Little did I know that. And this night, when I came to at 3 o'clock in the morning, I was real comfortable in my environment. I was laying underneath the plumbing up against the wall, probably where somebody had pushed me to. But I had one thing going for me. I was the best dressed drunk in that tank. I had, when I'd go out to drink, I'd put on the best I had. And it made a difference where I was going, walking the streets. You can see me walking the streets of East Dallas with a coat and tie. Because I didn't want people to know that I was who I was. I mean, no coat, I lied, but I'd been out on a job interview earlier that day, and I had on my best suit. And I still had that suit on. And it was the most expensive suit that I'd ever owned. And there I lay, and I crawled out from there, and I crawled up on the bench, and a guy handed me the phone. And I called my wife, and she said, I said, you need to get a lawyer and be down here at 7 o'clock in the morning to get here. And she said, I've got to go to work at 7 o'clock in the morning. And she hangs the phone up. Never done that before. So I thought, I'll call my own lawyer. So I get on, I remember the lawyer's name and I remember his phone number, and I called him, and his wife answered the phone. And she said, who is this? And I said, this is Larry Johnson. And I said, is Leon there? And she said, Larry, Leon died 2 years ago. And I hung the phone up, and I looked at my new business partner. And I don't know about you, I always went into business when I was in those places, and we just did that, and he said, when are you going to get out? And I said, I don't think I'm going to ever get out. He said, why? I said, my wife hung up on me, and my lawyer died. Now, there's nothing going for me now. But circumstances were such that the next morning I conned my way out of that deal, and it was 3 weeks later that I came in on a Sunday night, and this is what happened. Now, I go through my what happened real quick. Because we're going to eat lunch at noon, if they have to bring it out here to us. And we're going to eat lunch at noon. I came in and came home because I had nowhere else to go. I had some experiences that afternoon that I'd probably been having for a long time, and I just never realized the seriousness of my situation. I don't know if you know what it's like to stand in front of a pay telephone with a coin in your hand, trying to think of somebody to call. And you think, well, I'll call, and I can't call. And my good friend, Bob, I called Bob. And Bob told me last time I talked to him not to ever call him again. And there's no one to call, and I put the coin in my pocket, and I walk away from the phone. And I get home, and it's 10:30 on a Sunday night, and I walk in the house, and this time she doesn't say anything. She just looks. Didn't say, where you been? Or, I thought you weren't going to get drunk this time, or you're drunk again. She didn't say anything. And I said, Sam, I need some money. And she said, I don't have any money. I said, yeah, I know you, and we get to arguing about the money. She said, Larry, what I'm really saying is I don't have any money for you. I said, well, I don't understand. She said, what is it you don't understand about what I just said? I don't have any money for you. You ask for money, the answer is no. You know, no is a full sentence. You know, how hard is that to understand? You know, it doesn't need any interpretation. And so she and I thought, well, maybe I'm approaching this the wrong way, so I'll get tough. But she's not afraid anymore. And I never physically abused my wife. But God, the way I talked to that woman. God, the way I talked to her. And then that didn't work. And I thought, well, you know, our book talks about we're very much the actor. And the actor, you know, we could win an Academy Award sometimes for the way we can act. And I think that has been said. But I thought, you know, I really have not been very affectionate with her. And maybe that's what her problem is. So maybe a little loving would loosen her up a little bit. And, yeah, the gun was gone. Thank God for that. Nothing worked. And I don't remember a whole lot of other things that took place that night, but here's what happened. And I think that was the beginning of it. She had hit her bottom and let it be known that this is it, no more. She said, Larry, you're killing yourself and you're killing me and you're killing her. And her was a little two-year-old. Our daughter, Lori. And she said, we can't do this anymore. If you want to kill yourself, there's the door. Go do it. You know, I love you and I always will, but I can't watch you do this anymore. And I remember sitting in the middle of the floor and begging her, you go get the drink. I don't know about anybody else, but when I went 2 or 3 hours or so without a drink, I had to have a drink. And my whole body started trembling and my gut started to getting all knotted up, and I knew that the only thing that was going to settle that was a drink. And I said, would you please go get it? And she wouldn't go. And then that moment that we all have had, and it is really a moment, it all cleared up. They're right. They're right. The lawyer's right. She's right. The employers are right. And I need help. The lawyer had told me a couple of weeks before, son, if you don't get some help, Perry Mason ain't going to be able to help you stay out of that penitentiary. And those were his words. And I looked at her and I said, would you please find me some help. I can't do this anymore. I can't live like this anymore. I won't live like this any longer. And she said, who you want me to call? And now I don't know who to call. She's willing to make the call. I can't call AA. Never dawned on me to call AA. 2 years before that, a group of folks had set me down at the insane asylum in Turl, Texas, and said, son, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, not me, because I'm not an alcoholic. And Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics, and I'm not an alcoholic, so I'm not going to go. And I walked out of that treatment unit at the Turl State Hospital late on the eighth day. And an old man walked me to the door and put his arm around me, and he don't hear this much anymore, and he did me one of the greatest favors anybody could have done me that morning. He put his arm around me, and he said, son, if I have ever seen anybody needed a drink, it's you.
Now, you made this big spiel down here in the hall a while ago about you weren't like the rest of us and that you were leaving. What you need to do when you get back to Dallas is get you a jug and get in that jug and stay in there this time until you're ready. And maybe the next time when you come back down here, you'll be more like us. And I never thought to call them. But the TV was on. For some reason, the TV is always on at a drunk's house. I don't know why that is. But the TV was on. You just look. It is always on. And if it's not in the hawk shop, in my case, and this one wasn't, I never redeemed a pawn ticket. I'd pawn something and throw the ticket in the trash on the way out the door. I knew I wasn't coming back. But the TV was on, and on the TV was a commercial. And at the bottom, it was a commercial and on the for a hospital that, for alcoholics. It was kind of a new deal in Dallas. And we had two dried-out clinics. I didn't know about them. The graphic on the screen said, if you have a problem with alcohol, call this number. And I said, we call those people. So she called, and she talked to the man. And it was 11 o'clock on Sunday night, and he said, bring him up in the morning. And I agreed to go at 9 o'clock the next morning. When she hung the phone up, she put her coat on. And she started out the door, and I said, where are you going? She said, I'm going to get you something to drink. I said, why? You know, I've been over here pleading my case for an hour, and you wouldn't go. Why are you going? She said, because he said to. Because he knew. He knew that I would need that to get me through the night. He knew. And I thought, I don't know this man's name, but I'm looking forward to our appointment in the morning. Because he understands. And I'd be honest with you, I walked in his office that Monday morning, and if he'd have set a drink on the desk, I'd have took it. Because I don't know that I got to stop drinking to stop all this stuff from happening. I mean, I was going to slow down, moderate, do something. You know, about shoot me with something or fix me some way where I can quit living the way I'm living. You know, I suppose there's two kinds of people coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sure, and hopefully, and I believe today that I have fit the mold of both of those types of people. I went into that hospital today to change the circumstances in my life. And then I later came to Alcoholics Anonymous to change my life. That I changed my life to get my life to a point where I meet any circumstances on a daily basis. And I sat and I talked to this man, and through our conversation, he checked me into his hospital. And I stayed in his hospital for 28 days, and I asked him what's going to happen while I'm here. And he said, well, what's going to happen? He was the most honest guy. He said, he didn't make me any promises. He said, when you leave here, you're going to be as physically sober as you'll ever be. And that's what we're going to do. And made me no other promises except, he said, while you're here, you're going to meet some people. And these people, Larry, are going to show you how to stay sober. And he didn't say who they were, and I didn't ask. And they came. And they came in ones and twos. And this was back before our government got involved in this stuff. And members of Alcoholics Anonymous were free to go in and out of those places. Thank God for the freedom that we had when I sobered up, because I went many, many times. I went back in that hospital and sat night after night. I'd sit there and hold the hand of the fresh one and help him work himself through the DTs, because they didn't medicate you a whole lot up there. You had to really need it. But anyhow, they came. And a little man came one Friday night. Little bitty guy, 5'6". Powerful little man. And we met in a dining room, and they turned all the ceiling lights, and they had candles. It was a beautiful setup. Had candles on the table, and there'd be four people to a table. It was a beautiful setup. And the director of the hospital ran the meeting, and he introduced this fellow. He said, our speaker tonight is Dr. David A. And David come in, and had floodlights that shone down over the podium. And David walked under those lights, and I still believe to this day that the light got brighter. And I'd never heard anything like that in my life, and I was on the edge of my chair when the meeting was over. And I went up and I talked to him and told him how he had touched me. And because he was able to reach in and touch a part of me nobody else ever did before. And we went back up to the ward, and everybody was, you know, you just have a minute or so with the guy that gives the talk, and we went back up on the alcoholic ward of that hospital, and we were there about 5 minutes, and the elevator door opened, and off that elevator stepped this little guy. And he walked directly over to me and another guy, and he sat down, and he started talking. And we didn't have to send for him. We didn't have to send for him. And he didn't wait for us to come back to him. I believe that is the nature of the 12th step of our program. Well, you know, it says that we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. It doesn't say that we sat in the meeting room somewhere. We sat out on the front porch and waited for one to come to us. We wouldn't be here today if Bill had waited for Bob to come to him. But he came and he filled in all the blanks. And he gave me the formula for sobriety that night. He said, when you leave here, if you want to stay sober, here's some things that you must do. And I said, he said, go to meetings as many as you can get to. He hadn't come along, and that's not a bad idea. Except we need to, I always, if a guy wants to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, I remind him that the 91st day may be the most important day of his life. It's important to get back on day 91. But he said, go to meetings as many as you can get to. Read the book. And the book is this book. This book. Read the book. When we make reference to the book, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, this is the book we're talking about. Read the book every day. And get a sponsor. You know, I don't know about the sponsor. I hadn't heard much about the sponsor. But get a sponsor. Take and use the steps in your life. You know that forward to the 12 and 12 doesn't say anything about it. It just says, when practiced as a way of life. I think it's what this man was saying, to take and use the steps in your life and work with others. And you never have to take another drink as long as you want to. Now, he said all of that before he said you never have to take another drink unless you want to. And sometimes it's kind of misleading. We set a guy down, and he's been to his first AA meeting, and somebody has talked, or we've had discussion, and we've had coffee and gone for ice cream, and we pat him on the back and say, you never have to take another drink unless you want to. Go to meetings as many as you can get to. Read the book every day. Get a sponsor. Take and use the steps in your life. Work with others, and you never have to take another drink unless you want to. And you won't want to if you do that. And he said, if you leave any of that out, you're going to lessen your chances for sobriety. And I left that place, and I made my first AA meeting. The week before I left there, I made my first AA meeting. I left on a Monday. They were having a Monday night meeting. I was there. We went to meetings on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. That's all the meetings we had. Had three meetings a week, and I was there. And I started going to meetings, my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard the greatest AA talk I ever heard at that meeting. There were two men standing at the front door that welcomed me into Alcoholics Anonymous. We got groups popping up around Dallas. I don't know what y'all are doing up here, but down we got some groups popping up down there now. They've got this new concept. It's called greeters. And they thought they had something new. These two men stood on the door. One of these fellows sobered up in 1955, and the other sobered up in 1960. And this is 1972, and they're out there greeting folks. Now, what kind of, that's example. And I had some great examples in my life in the beginning in AA, and I thank God for them. And I knew that, and finally, you come, the cloud kind of went away, and I love that cloud. Let me tell you, if you're on it, kind of hang in there as long as you can, but get a sponsor, you know, because you're coming down, and when your feet hit the ground, and things start showing back up in your life, and I knew that I had a lot of work to do, and I started out on this journey called the 12 Steps, and I took the first step while I was in that hospital. I took the second and third step in the Dallas County Jail, and I had to go to jail after I got sober, because you got to pay your dues. I didn't want to go, but I had to go, and I went. And I couldn't take y'all with me. I couldn't take my book, my big book with me. But I had just enough exposure to you all when I got there to know that all this fear that I was feeling was because I'd never taken the second and third step. And I took the second and third step when I was there. When I come out of there, I did the inventory, I did the fifth step, and I know I'm running out of time. And then I get over in, I think, the two most beautiful steps in our program, and that's step 8 and 9. And I got a list of people that I have brought harm to. And not necessarily a list of people that I'm resentful at. I did that in the fourth step. These are people I harmed. And the nature of the 8th and 9th step is to make amends where harm has been done. So I got to go out and I got to make amends to people I have harmed. And the nature of the amends that was taught to me is when I go to these people, I stand in front of them and I say to them, what I did to you, or my behavior, or whatever the situation, whatever it merits, was wrong. I was wrong. And what I need to do to square the books between you and I, and be ready to do that. And there's that little family back in North Carolina, they're still back there. And I talked to my sponsor and I said, you know that I can't make that amends. He said, why? I said, it says, except when to do so would injure them or others. He said, I don't understand. Why you can't make that amends? I said, do you realize that if I go back there, they could put me in jail? He said, so? I said, her daddy told me if I ever showed up on his property again, he was going to shoot me. He said, so? You'd be sober. Easy for him to say. He's not the one getting shot. But I knew I had, he said, Larry, you have to do this. You have to do this to acquire the freedom you're going to need to live the rest of your life. And remember, we agreed at the beginning that it would go to any lengths. And I sat down one day and I wrote her a letter. The book said it's okay to do that. A man we know had remarried, got a job, got his head above water, came and joined us and hadn't kept up the alimony to number one, and she was furious and she went to court and she got an order for arrest for him, and that was her. That was Betty Lou. Did all of that. But he wrote her a letter and sent a small amount of money and asked basically for an opportunity to straighten out and right a wrong. And that's basically what the letter said. I mailed the letter on Thursday. Monday she called. On Monday afternoon, I answered the phone, and this voice said, is this Larry? And I said, yes. She said, this is Betty. And I knew that. And she said, we got your letter today, and we've read it, and we wanted to call. This is something I'm a bit proud of this part of my story. I don't tell this with any pride, but I have to tell it. And I have to tell it with all the honesty that I can, because it's my story, and I can't change it. But like all AA stories, one day at a time, have happy endings. And she said, and she's been over 9 years since she knew how to pick up a phone and call me. And we talked, and the phone was picked up on an extension. I heard an extension phone being picked up, and I heard her say, Kim, put the phone down. And Kim was my little girl. And the last time I had seen Kim, Kim was 10 months old. And Kim's 10 years old. And the first words I ever heard her say was, I want to talk to my daddy. And she let me talk to her, and then she put my son Darrell on the phone, and we talked. And then and the night before Thanksgiving, 1974, my wife Sam and our daughter Lori met Kim and Darrell at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. And what my sponsor has said came true. Stop worrying so much about where you can't go. Do what you're supposed to do. Sometimes they come to us. And they came. And we started this process of a family being put back together through the facilities of Alcoholics Anonymous and the Al-Anon family groups. And now I was able to become a father to these children. That's all they really wanted to be, was their father. And I've been allowed to do this. I've been allowed to walk my daughters, both of them, down the aisle and give them a couple of jackasses. I really don't like that part of a wedding where you give your daughter to someone. But I told them both the same thing. No matter what ever happens, you'll always be my little girl. And they still are, and I still treat them like my little girls. And my son and I have got a little different kind of relationship. We have the kind of relationship that he wants us to have. And he loves me, and I love him. We don't talk a lot, but I know that the love is there when I'm around him. And I've got to close. When David died in July, it became necessary for me to get another sponsor. And I went over to North Carolina, and I sat down with a man that I respect and admire as much as anyone that I have ever known. And I believe that that's who my sponsor needs to be, is someone I respect and someone I admire and someone that I would like to be like. And I sat down and I talked to Tom for 3 hours. And Tom told me one thing. He said, "Larry, I am emphatic about one thing." And I was told the same thing by David. He said, "I insist on respect." Not so much, he wasn't talking about me respecting him. He knew I respected him or I wouldn't be there. "I insist that you treat Alcoholics Anonymous with all the respect that you're able to treat it with. Never do anything that would bring any disrespect to our fellowship. Be respectable. Dress up for AA. Don't dress down. Be respectable, and you'll gain the respect of the people around you." I walk into the Bruton Terrace group in Mesquite, Texas. I feel the respect of the members in that group when I walk in there. When I go to that meeting tomorrow night, and I'll be there, I will feel the respect and the love of the members of that group because I'm dedicated to my group. And I'm regular in my attendance, and I'm generous in my giving to my group. When I get home tomorrow evening from this little deal, and I have another stop on the way home, but when I get in tomorrow evening, I walk in that house, and that woman in that house respects me and loves me, and I respect her, and I love her. And sometimes we exchange that verbally, but it's a known fact. I mean, you feel that. And I can tell you now, if there's a dirty dish in the sink, we don't hold a workshop on good housekeeping. Not anymore. I just simply wash the dish and put it away and keep my mouth shut. That has done wonders for our marriage. When we retire tomorrow night to go to bed, she and I, out of the respect and the love that we have for each other, we'll join each other in our nighttime meditation. Our book says that we invite our wives to join us in that if circumstances warrant. We do that. I think that the line, "What an order, I can't go through with it," wouldn't be in our book if that last few words and practice these principles in all our affairs. And that's all I'm trying to do, and I don't want to impress you with the fact that I do this perfectly. But we just give it the best shot we got a day at a time. If you're new, you come on out there with us and enjoy and take it all. Don't leave anything out. Don't leave anything out. You know, enjoy the journey. It's a tremendous journey that we're on. Enjoy the journey. And you will find, as many of us have, that life has took on a new meaning. Thank you very much. Thank you.